Welcome to Diddy and Hawthorne in the In-Between, or DH&I. I'm your host, Mackenzie Gentz, and you're listening to our podcast about the relevance of literature in the 21st century. Now bookmark that book, and let's begin.
Hello, hello, and welcome to the show. Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu unserem Podcast. Today's topic is one that got splashed onto me pretty literally when I started reading The Garden of Eden by Ernest Hemingway, one of several of Hemingway's posthumous works, in my opinion, the oddest and most distant of all of them from his original writing, but I digress. We've formatted the episode today in three different parts. Part one, what I know about posthumism. Part two, what I didn't know about posthumism. And part three, conclusion. Each part also begins with quotes from The Garden of Eden, all of which I feel are very genuine in their adherence to Hemingway's original style, because this episode is in many ways about me trying to figure out The Garden of Eden post-read. But before we begin, I wanted to give a shout out to those of you on our email list. You guys are the unsung heroes of each month for us at the show. I adore our newsletter, which is called Ex Libris DH&I, or From the Shelves of DH&I, and that newsletter gives everyone exclusive updates about the show. It was the second place I announced the topics for Horrifying Classics, as well as the TDFW after episodes, and a place that I just take a lot of solace in, because it's where I talk about what's happening and also about what the upcoming things are in the world of literature. To sign up for the newsletter, simply visit our homepage, relevanceofliterature.com, scroll to the very bottom of the page, and put your email in at that little box. Part 1. What I know about posthumous works. The Garden of Eden, page 108. But the beer on this coast was worthless, and he thought happily of Paris and other places he had been, and was pleased he had written something he knew was good and that he had finished it. This was the first writing he had finished since they were married. Finishing is what you have to do, he thought. If you don't finish, nothing is worth a damn. Tomorrow I'll pick up the narrative where I left it and keep right on until I finish it. And how are you going to finish it? How are you going to finish it now? I know quite a lot about posthumism, but I'm going to stick to the bare bones here and start by looking at the things and the works that I know, works that I've read. I have read A Movable Feast by Ernest Hemingway, one of his other more dramatic posthumous works, definitely that changed the opinion of him in the public eye. I've read a lot of posthumous works from Kurt Vonnegut. There's tons of interviews and little novellas and things that came out after he died in the early 2000s. David Foster Wallace obviously has some posthumous works. The Pale King is the most notable of them. A highly lauded work of fiction after he passed away. Virginia Woolf has these great diaries that are called Diaries of a Writer, and they just give such an amazing in-depth perspective of her writing. I'm a huge fan of those. My case study for this part is, of course, The Garden of Eden by Ernest Hemingway, and as always, all my sources are linked in the show notes for this episode at relevanceofliterature.com/notes. The first and most glaring thing that I noticed was the length of The Garden of Eden, because the manuscript is over 800 pages and 200,000 words, while the novel is only 70,000 words. It is the length of a normal, quote-unquote, normal Hemingway novel, but there are parts of it that read like textbook Hemingway, and parts of it that don't read like Hemingway at all. In particular, another jarring element of the novel is the myriad of supporting themes that the book explores. Surprising to Hemingway, that is, as in reading the book, we get a totally different view of him. These themes include race, insanity, gender roles and gender bending, sexuality and polyamory, and a symbolic breaking from Western norms and ideals. Excepting perhaps the last theme there, these are not the themes that one expects to be thinking about while reading a Hemingway novel like The Sun Also Rises or To Whom the Bell Tolls. I would also be remiss not to mention how complex the Garden of Eden is, just on the basis of plot as well, as there are a few overlapping storylines that he exchanges as the novel continues. Not unlike the Stephen King book Misery, might I add, though Hemingway arguably did it first. Between the main narrative thread with David Bourne and his wife Catherine, our main characters, and some threads, for example, that demonstrate the content of David Bourne's short stories about Africa. Some characteristics that I'm drawing generally from my knowledge of posthumous novels that I've read and studied: they are typically unfinished at the time of the author's death, leading to quite heavy revisions and editing, a lot of which gathers scorn as the novel's popularity rises, if it does write, and indeed. And sometimes there's additional writing as well that has to be done, and that is clearly not great for mentions of the authenticity of these works. Also, there's tactics of name recognition in terms of the branding, right? We wouldn't even want a posthumous work, probably, unless it's an author that sells really well. There's politics and involved, especially with these revisions and who's revising them and how scholars in the future look at those revisions. It's a way to sometimes extend an author's legacy, as in the case of DFW, or explore an avenue that the author meant to go down but didn't have time to. I would consider this very applicable to Hemingway in this manner. Now I just have some questions leading into part two of our episode today. Question one, who profits from selling posthumous works? Question two, who benefits from selling posthumous works? And question three, what are the circumstances behind deciding to publish posthumous material? Part two, what I didn't know about posthumous works. The Garden of Eden, page 37. The next morning, there was still heavy surf and the rain came in gusts. They could not see the Spanish coast, and when it cleared between the driven squalls of rain and they could see across the angry sea in the bay, there were heavy clouds that came down to the base of the mountains. Catherine had gone out in a raincoat after breakfast and had left him to work in the room. It had gone so simply and easily that he thought it was probably worthless. "Be careful," he said to himself. "It is all very well for you to write simply, and the simpler the better. But do not start to think so damn simply. Know how complicated it is, and then state it simply. Do you suppose the Grau de Roy time was all simple because you could write a little of it simply?" All right, let's start by looking at some secondary sources relating to the Garden of Eden. I'm going to pull a few quotes here from the very interesting and very thorough historical text linked below at the show notes. First quote here is from page VIII. "Critics scrutinize the work of editor Tom Jenks," the editor who made, for lack of a better word, the Garden of Eden, "and question Scribner's motives for presenting this complex posthumous novel as a trade book with no scholarly apparatus. Over time, scholars have continued to lament the fact that they must work with the edited version of the text or consult with the complete manuscript in the Hemingway collection of the John F. Kennedy Library." Second quote is from page IX or 9. "In fact, we do not believe it is an overstatement to say that the publication of the novel and scholarly work on it represent one of the most significant and comprehensive editorial and critical interventions in the study of American literature in the past half century," again regarding the Garden of Eden. And finally on page X, "His mandate to salvage a coherent and publishable story from the manuscript was in many ways at odds with scholars' interest in the details of the manuscript, in particular its multiple plot lines and overlapping characters, as well as the palimpsest of revisions." Based on these quotes, as well as the other sources in the description, who profits has a relatively straightforward answer: the publishing houses, as well as in some cases the families of the deceased for bringing the work in the first place. Indeed, the people who profit are the people working on making the manuscripts publishable. who benefits becomes a rather complicated question in my mind because it's multifaceted in the respect that depending on whom you ask, the response will be different. In some cases, as with the Virginia Woolf diaries, in my opinion at least, the family benefited by contributing to her body of work, the diaries were edited by Woolf's nephew, and in that case I believe that publishing posthumously was both a method of grieving and a means for closure for the family. It's really up to each of us individually as scholars to decide whether, for example, academia benefits or whether the public benefits from these kinds of works. From what I've encountered, most of the time people put an author's posthumous work in another category for the purposes of study anyway, so I tend to err on the side that it's better to have them in the catalog than to not have them at all, withstanding, of course, that we also have the original manuscript to use for comparative studies. And to answer the third question, the circumstances of publishing The Garden of Eden were that it was a project that especially the publishing company was very much interested in pursuing because of Hemingway's acclaim, but they had to wait for someone to come along who had the skill and also the motivation to take the manuscript and craft it into something publishable. I find that similarly for other works, the impetus to publish something posthumously often comes from either the publishing company or from the family, and from there it's a hunt to find individuals who can make sense of a work that is only half completed. This process of making sense of the work, finding scholarly reasons for decisions with the text, etc., often takes years, and thereafter the publishing process generally continues to what we would normally see when publishing a book. Alright, before we reach some conclusions here, we're going to take a quick break. I clearly have an unabridged, childish excitement for Halloween. That is why we do such a blown-up, horrifying classic series every single year. But you know what else I love? Extending horrifying classics to our Patreon page, where we will be reading an extra spooktastic book for our October Patreon-only podcast. Signing up at patreon.com/relevanceofliterature is an inexpensive and simple way to ensure that the show continues to take flight like a bat, because Halloween is near. See you all on Patreon. Part 3, Conclusion. Page 131 of The Garden of Eden. On the shiny black road that mounted through the pines as he left the hotel, he felt the pull in his arms and his shoulders and the rounding thrust of his feet against the pedals as he climbed in the hot sun with the smell of the pines and the light breeze that came from the sea. He bent his back forward and pulled lightly against his hands and felt the cadence that had been ragged as he first mounted begin to smooth out as he's passed the 100-meter stones and then the first red-topped kilometer marker and then the second. At the headland, the road dipped to border the sea and he braked and dismounted and put the bicycle over his shoulder and walked down with it along the trail to the beach. He propped it against a pine tree that gave off the resin smell of the hot day, and he dropped down to the rocks, stripped and put his espadrilles on his shorts, shirt and cap, and he drove from the rocks into the deep, clear, cold sea. He came up through the varying light, and when his head came out, he shook it to clear his ears and then swam out to sea. He lay on his back and floated and watched the sky and the first white clouds that were coming with the breeze. In conclusion, posthumous texts comprise a category of literature that is riddled with complexity when it comes to the moral and scholarly decisions behind each individual work. But as previously mentioned, it is up to readers and scholars themselves to determine how authentic and accurate each work is, depending on a wide variety of factors, including but not limited to the themes, characters, style, length, and revisions of the novel. And while The Garden of Eden is not textbook Hemingway, and not even remotely what I expected when I opened the book for the first time, I'm glad that we have it, if only to demonstrate how different posthumous works can be. If you enjoyed the discussion and would like to hear more from us, there is a show and a series for everyone, so I'd recommend checking out our website, relevanceofliterature.com, under the Ongoing Series tab, for links to our entire back catalog of episodes.
We also have a couple of open surveys that you can find through the links in the description. So if you have 3 minutes while you're waiting in line somewhere, we would very much appreciate your feedback on our show. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode, and we'll see you next time.